And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm delighted to welcome Lisa Patton back to the program today. Lisa is the author of the novels Whistlin' Dixie and a Nor'easter, Yankee Doodle Dixie, and Southern as a Second Language. Today we'll be talking about her new novel Rush, which is set in the world of a Southern university sorority. So, Lisa, why did you choose Ole Miss as the setting for Rush?
I went to the University of Alabama, and I decided to choose Ole Miss because it was the same story both places, but I feel like Oxford is a much more colorful town, more history there to write about, and to be honest, they don't win as many football games as the Tide does, and I didn't want anybody to not want to read my book because they were jealous of the Tide. Wink, wink.
I mean, the Tide has a much better chant than Ole Miss does, that hotty-totty nonsense.
It's too much fun not to include that in the book, though. It is so much fun, that hotty-totty. I do love the chant. In fact, I thought about going to Ole Miss many, many times, but I ended up at Alabama. My dear high school friend and I drove onto the campus, saw it, and looked at each other and said, "This is the place for us."
Was there a particular reason you named the sorority in question Alpha Delta Beta?
It had to be three Greek letters or two that had never been used before. And that was the only one that I could think of and find in my research that was not a real sorority and had never been put together. So I nicknamed it the Alpha Delts as well. So Alpha Delta Beta or the Alpha Delts.
At what point in thinking about the story did you decide to have three first-person narrators?
I knew I wanted to make the story first-person, or I should say I knew I wanted to write the story in first-person. I relate better, and as an author, for some reason, I can become that character when it's in first-person. So that was the first decision I needed to make. And as far as three different characters, I wanted to do that so I could tell the entire story. I needed to give three different points of view. One, a young girl who was going through recruitment at Ole Miss, and then an alum advisor so I could tell about some things going on inside of the house. And of course, Miss Pearl, the housekeeper, who would give the story from her perspective and what it was like to work there and become close friends with the girls.
Now, how did Miss Pearl come to Alpha Delta in the first place?
What I've learned in my research is in real life, people who work at the sorority houses come to those positions from word of mouth. They are coveted positions and they hear about it from their family members and close friends. So Miss Pearl came to work in the Alpha Delta Beta house because her aunt, Aunt Fee, had been a cook there for quite some years at the time. So that's how Miss Pearl got her job there.
Some people might assume that this is through the university they're hired, but no, it's individually through each house, isn't it?
Yes. Although, from what I understand these days, particularly at Alabama, some of the staff at the houses are becoming university employees. Well, at least the house mothers are, or they are replacing the staff with food services, but not everywhere. And yes, the sororities themselves hire members of their own staff, and they're not employed by the university. No, they're employed by the individual sororities in most campuses.
And so since it's probably a small group they have, benefits aren't always available.
No, they're not available. In some rare instances, health insurance is available. But from what I understand, the employees have to pay a percentage of the premium and oftentimes can't afford that. So they don't always participate in those programs. Some do, some don't.
And it seems that the Panhellenic organizations of the past, you know, public service has been a big portion of what their raison d'etre is, but they didn't always treat their employees very well.
Are you talking about within the Panhellenic Society?
Yeah, all the different houses and fraternities and sororities.
Yes, traditionally, I think one of the interesting things to me is the members of the staff have always bonded with the kids in school. And I don't think you can talk to many sorority or fraternity members who don't have a story of someone who works in the house that they've become close with, who's acted like a second mother while they were in college, or a dad, and done nice things for them. But traditionally, I believe it's not something that anyone's really thought about, that everybody gets busy with their own lives. And I believe the students aren't supposed to be thinking about it. It's more of an issue for the House Core Board who makes these decisions. But I really find that a lot of people on the House Core Boards just haven't thought about it.
Pearl didn't have the intention of working inside a sorority house.
No.
I mean, she did start attending Ole Miss quite a few years ago.
Yes, she was really smart and got a scholarship to Ole Miss. And then something happened in her life that is sort of the secret that she carries that kept her from continuing her education. And she had to drop out of school. So that's when her Aunt Fee encouraged her to come and work at the Ole Miss sorority house there, the Alpha Delta house, and get a job. And that's how she started, at minimum wage, working in the kitchen. And fast forward to today, in my book, she's been there 25 years.
Ironically, had she gone through the work for the university proper, she could have gotten tuition benefits and stuff like that would have helped her further her career a lot sooner.
Correct. That's right. But she loves working at the sorority house. She loves the girls. They treat her well. She loves the environment. The girls have really encouraged her to get back to school. They're good friends. And she's built a lot of friendships working at the sorority house. And she loves it.
Now, how many Alpha Delta student members are there, and how many actually live inside the house?
There are 438 girls in the sorority, and 66 of them live in the house.
So how do they choose who gets to live in the house?
It's normally, I'm not sure how each sorority house does it, but it's normally reserved for seniors, or the officers sometimes get to move in sooner, and they might live there 2 years. But living in the sorority house is usually just 1 year.
I was surprised on how much it costs to be a member of one of these Panhellenic organizations.
Well, it's not cheap. It's not cheap. The dues go towards keeping that house running. And there are a lot of expenses in that. To have a full-time staff to keep up with the renovations. I know houses all over the SEC, they're having to be either renovated or torn down to accommodate more students going through rush. But there's a big overhead at a sorority house. They also give a lot of money to different philanthropic organizations. Each house has their own philanthropy that they support. They do fundraising efforts. There is a lot of overhead to operate a huge sorority house like that. There's a house mother. There's often a staff of at least 7 to 11 people. Of course, not just the maintenance on the house, but the mortgage, if there still is one. There's, you know, the power and lights, and there's all kinds of the food that the girls eat. All of that is included in those dues.
Back to Pearl real quick. Pearl has an ideal man. Who is he?
Usher.
Why does she love Usher so much?
Because Usher is so good looking. He's got a beautiful voice, and every time he comes on The Voice or on television, she's just dying to meet him, and she just thinks if they could just have one chance encounter, he'd fall in love with her, and that would be her ticket to really getting the man she wants. Of course, she doesn't even know if Usher has a wife, which I'm sure he does, but to Pearl, it's part of her fantasy.
It's an undertaking fraught with a lot of ways to make mistakes, writing across cultures, writing across race, especially when a white author takes on the voice of an African-American person. What steps did you have to take in order to minimize your errors and be honest and true to Pearl and not be insulting in any way?
That was the hardest part about writing the entire novel. I met a lady, actually I was introduced to her by a friend from Ole Miss, who was a former housekeeper at a sorority house there. We became friends. And she was eager to share her story with me because she, too, hopes for change. in that the people who dedicate so many years of their life working in these jobs, that they would be able to get higher wages and better benefits. So this particular lady and I became friends. She actually came and stayed with me when she came to Nashville to graduate from college. She went to Argosy University, and they had the graduation in Nashville when she got her master's. She helped me to learn her character from the inside out. We would text weekly. We talked on the phone every few weeks. She gave me an honest accounting of exactly what it was like to work in that house. I also ran the book by a Black friend of mine in Nashville for her to read it. And although she has never been in a domestic situation and couldn't really relate to being in that position, she felt like it was okay. She gave me the thumbs up. But mostly it was built on my friend from Oxford, who lives there now, explaining everything about it. And that character, I believe, is the person who works in the sorority house. Not everybody has her personality, but many of the people that I have met, I felt like, had that personality. Now, yes, it is very hard to be a white girl and speaking for a Black girl, but my heart was in the right place, and I can't say that I didn't make a mistake and that I did it perfectly, but I know that I tried, and I tried to give voice to someone who didn't have a voice. Oftentimes, that can be viewed as white saviorism. That's not what I was trying to do, because without a white person making this change, it will not happen. It can't happen. So my heart was to present a situation through the power of story to people who had been in sororities like myself, so that they might fall in love with my characters. There's that old saying that says, the shortest distance between the human heart and truth is a story. So I knew if I could create one and have my readers fall in love with the characters, that perhaps they would be moved for social change.
As I understand, there was a real-life event that kind of gave you the spark for the story.
You know, there was. I went to the ribbon cutting of our new sorority house at the University of Alabama with one of my very best childhood friends. And she actually named Wilda after her. She's Wilda, and she lives here, and so many people know her. And she and I went down to the sorority house, and I noticed one of the staff members, the housekeeper, that day. And remember that all the sorority houses at Alabama have been torn down, and the ones that have taken their places are 40,000 square feet. So that's not cheap for a 40,000 square foot home. And I noticed the housekeeper, and she was pushing her dust mop down the long hall. And I noticed all the girls going up to her, the collegians, and I loving her, hugging on her, telling her they loved her. And she was so sweet back to them. And I thought, gosh, I want to meet her. So I introduced myself, and we started talking. And I asked her if she liked working there, and she said she loved it. And I asked her how long she'd been there, and she said 25 years. And I was taken aback. I said, my goodness, that's a long time. You must know quite a bit about this place. And she, of course, yes, ma'am, to me, and we were the same age. And I told her she didn't have to say yes, ma'am, to me, but she couldn't help it. She said, yes, ma'am. And at one point, she took me down the hall, took me by the hand, actually, and led me over to last year's composite and pointed out to me a picture of her best friend on the composite, who was the cook at the sorority house, and she had recently died of cancer. And this lady had tears rolling down her face, and I could tell she was so sad about it. And I said, and I am a cancer survivor, and I said, I'm so sorry. I said, what happened? And she said she never would go to the doctor. And I said, why? And she didn't want to tell me, and she didn't want to tell me. And at this point, we'd been talking for about an hour. And I said, you can tell me. And then reluctantly, she told me that she didn't have any health insurance. And none of them did, and they couldn't afford to go to the doctor. And that stopped me in my tracks, and it broke my heart. And it never would leave me, her story. I got home, and I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I thought about it, and I thought about it. And then that's when I started my research, and I learned it was a widespread issue all over the SEC and maybe all over the country. It's not just the South. You know, we have big sorority houses at Penn State and the University of California. So I didn't research there. I just kept my research to the South. But I thought something had to change. And, you know, whether you believe in God or not, I believe God had me in that moment, in that place for that reason. And I happened to have a major publishing contract, and I could open the door and tell the story to many people in hopes for change. So that's what motivated me. In fact, there were times where I remember saying to myself, no, not me. I'm not the one to tell this story. But it never would go away. So that's how I knew I was the one to tell the story. And when I met the lady at Ole Miss who was able to give me her account of the goings-on from her perspective, and we became good friends, that's how I knew. It's me. I'm the one that has to tell the story. And I'm proud of that, and I'm really glad I did.
I saw something on Twitter recently, and it was talking about, do you need to comment on a tweet? And it said, does this comment need to be said? Does it need to be said by you? Does it need to be said now? And it seems all three of those answers are yes for you.
They really were, Stephen. Thank you for bringing up about seeing that comment on Twitter, because that gives me pause, and it makes me more and more convicted that that's what I felt like I needed to do. Whether someone else thinks it or not, I don't have any control over. But in that moment and the many following, I knew this is what I needed to do. And I got to say, I'm spending so much of my time and money on it that this is not a money-making project, but it's something that my heart said needed to be told.
And you present complex characters on all sides of the story, and that you can't rely on someone to be just a wonderful person all the way through. They are human. They will make mistakes.
Yes.
And even the people who seem ill in their intent aren't all bad either.
No. And it was important to me to show that. Even my villain of the story, it was important to me to show that she has a breaking point and that she came from an environment where she was taught racism. And it wasn't the way she chose to be raised, but that happens. And I am someone that believes that while it's hard for people to change, that all things are possible. And you can't discount anyone. So it was important to me to give a lot of conflict and to give that complexity to each character, to show the human side of things.
Our second narrator is Wilda Woodcock. How does she fit into the Alpha Delt story?
Well, Wilda, hopefully, is my comic relief character, and I love that about her. She starts off the story as someone who isn't the most self-confident woman in the world, and she is chosen by an old sorority sister to become an advisor, a Rush advisor. And her daughter is going through Rush, and she's told that it would be a way to see her daughter more often. And she was about to be an empty nester, so she jumped on it. She was so excited to be an advisor. She had never done anything like that before, and she thought, why not? So she was thrilled. But what she didn't know at the time is the woman who asked her, the villain of my story, someone has to be the villain, Lilith, what Wilda didn't know is that Lilith was doing this on purpose, that she had an ulterior motive, that Wilda shouldn't have been an advisor if she had a child going through Rush, that that's completely against the rules. But Lilith did it behind everyone's back.
Now, in researching how recruitment goes on for current-day Greek organizations, how did it differ from when you were young and went through it?
First of all, our pledge class, as we called it back then, were 42 people. 42 women, I should say, and we were the largest pledge class ever. Today, at least at Alabama, I think 2 years ago, they actually had a pledge class of 170, and normally they're around 130 these days. So as you can see, it's grown exponentially. It's also different in that it didn't seem to be as hard to get in. You didn't need so many letters of recommendations. Whereas today, they are very careful about the kind of grades that a girl makes. There are some sororities that require a 4.0 grade average. Back when I was in school, that was not something that we had to worry about. In fact, I don't even remember having many recs, and I don't even remember worrying that I would get cut from Rush. Whereas today, that's a big deal. Girls worry about it a lot, and causes a lot of anxiety. The fact my sister's daughter is going through Rush, and their whole dining room table became an assembly line of putting together all the rec packets, which have a resume and two or three pictures and a collage of pictures and a letter from the potential member and a letter from the mother and a letter from somebody else, and you put it together in a fancy package and then in a fancy envelope and mail it to each individual sorority. So it's a big deal these days, and it does cause a bit of anxiety. And your parents, if they're the ones who are going to pay for it, they need to have that kind of expendable income. Because one of my characters in the book, Callie, she doesn't come from that kind of money. She has to pay for it herself. And she wanted to be in a sorority so intensely, she dreamed about it for so long, that she saved her own money. But it's a financial commitment for sure.
Now, how did Ellie and Annie Laurie become roommates?
Because Lilith, my antagonist, contacted Wilda when she heard that both of their daughters were going to be attending the university and both going out for Rush. So she called Wilda and asked if her daughter would be interested in rooming with her daughter. So Annie Laurie is Lilith's daughter, and Ellie is Wilda's daughter. And that happens. Old sorority sisters might hear of each other's daughters getting together and think that could just be a fabulous idea, because many girls go to college and don't know their roommates, but they know of them, or they know a family member or someone has recommended. So that happens quite often.
But they have kind of different expectations of what a college dorm room might be decorated like.
Well, that's where I had the most fun of the story. That part came out really easy, because when I learned that dorm room decorators are a thing or the trend, I think myself as a person, I went, what? Yes, dorm room decorators are the trend. So I had a little fun with that. I may have exaggerated just a little bit, but if you go on Facebook or Instagram and see the dorm rooms that have been decorated by dorm room decorators, you wouldn't really think I exaggerated too much in the story. They're gorgeous and oftentimes more beautiful than a lot of rooms in people's homes today. I mean, they're gorgeous.
I know the trend of making college a more real-world experience as opposed to cinder blocks, metal frames, and just a mattress with springs underneath. It's very different from when we were in school.
I lived in stadium apartments, which has now been torn down, and the new University of Alabama stadium sits on top of it. But we had an orange faux, more faux plastic than faux leather couch that the stadium apartments supplied, with big rips in the middle, and the beds were probably 40-year-old mattresses that were pushed up against the walls, and we didn't have matching anything, and I don't think we really cared. I don't think it was anything we worried about ever.
And now they've got ensuite bathrooms and
marble entryways and beautiful faux marble countertops, and it's quite a turnaround.
No wonder college costs so much.
That's right.
When she commits to spending a lot of money on this dorm room, it gives people leverage over her because she does not deal honestly with her husband, Haynes, about the cost.
That it does. She wasn't honest with her husband. And I was able to write that in because I think that women everywhere have not always been honest with their husbands about the money that they spend. But what happens is it digs her into a big, deep hole because she hides it from him. And the worst part is she borrowed the money from her mother.
And her mother is a piece of work.
Her mother is a piece of work. And I'm glad you brought her mother up because I base that mother on a lot of people I know. And she was so much fun. And that's where I had the most fun in the story, is writing those scenes, because literally sometimes I had tears rolling down my face laughing at the thought of the conversations with Wilda and her mother, because I know so many mothers of yesteryear like that.
Now, while Haynes can't stand the Whitmore family,
no,
or at least the parents.
No, he can't.
Wilda's mother just is enchanted by them.
Absolutely, because of all their money and because of their historic home down in Natchez. She thinks they are what everybody should aspire to be, and that is marry into great wealth. And she feels like by having this girl, as she calls her, the Whitmore girl, as her roommate, she tells Wilda, that's a rare coup. I think this is exactly what our Ellie needs to be friends with Miss Annie Laurie Whitmore. Why, her parents, look at their historic home down in Natchez. I'm so happy for her.
Now, you mentioned her a little bit early before. Callie.
Yes.
Comes from Blue Mountain, Mississippi.
Yes.
And she does not have what they call pedigree.
No, she does not. And she didn't even really understand that whole concept of pedigree in a family, because that's just not how she lives or where she lives. She doesn't come from that. But what she's dying to do is belong in a sorority for all the benefits, the sisterhood and the belonging, because her family itself, she's been raised by her grandparents. Her family itself is broken, and she has a lot of dysfunction in her family. And she longs to escape that and start over and be with girls that she can be close to. And Callie is extremely smart. Her desire is to be the first female governor in the state of Mississippi. So when she goes to Ole Miss, that's the first thing on her mind. And she knows that sororities can help her, because I think there's a statistic out there that only a handful of our presidents since fraternities were started have not been fraternity members. And many, many members of Congress and the Senate are Greek. And Callie knows this, and she thinks that sororities will help her to attain that goal. And she's really smart. She's been accepted into the Honors College, and so she's going for sororities whether she has a pedigree or not.
Now, she's a very spunky redhead who's not tall of stature. Sounds very familiar.
You know, all writers have to write what they know.
Now, I will say it just about broke my heart when, after finished helping her move into her dorm, when they wanted to pray with her, and she felt embarrassed by that.
She was. She was embarrassed because she had this idea of fitting in, and she didn't see anybody else doing it. So she didn't want to do it with her grandparents, and they were so sad when she didn't want to. But Callie is trying to escape her past. She doesn't want to bring it in with her to college, so she doesn't want to draw any attention to herself at all. She just wants to mold into the background and be one of those people. But in this book, she becomes anything but. She becomes quite a leader, but at first, she really doesn't want her past to come with her to college.
I will say there are quite a few of the characters that don't have fathers or even either parent in their lives.
And I think I did that to show and to be true to the characters, because without a father, oftentimes most times I would say people lose an important sense of self-confidence and identity that a father brings into a young girl's life. That was one of the reasons, since they didn't have the father, that they all could relate to one another. And I think that is the situation with so many people I know, and either an absentee father or someone who has passed away or from divorce. But I think it's so important for a young girl to have a strong father figure in her life for her self-confidence. And that's the reason I did that.
I really like that the younger women in the story weren't boy crazy, that they had other things on their mind. It wasn't all about chasing someone to go to a dance with or something like that. And the older women who didn't have partners, that they were resolved, they had their own lives to lead, and they didn't necessarily need that complication.
That's right. And that's the woman who is emerging today, is more confident and has that voice and feels more room to be who she is and who she wants to be, and the woman who doesn't need a man to complete her or to inspire her to become her true self. And although we need men and we want men, that's not it. It's just, this story was not about that. It was about women discovering their voices and their own empowerment. And that was left out intentionally.
There are just very few little male roles in there. They have a line or two, and then they shuffle off to their areas and let the women take care of the business.
They have in this book, because it was set inside a sorority house and the women are running it. Men aren't doing that. So they needed to make their own decisions, and we needed to see all parts of those women without introducing men that would distract from getting to know those characters. I only had, well, this one's 406 pages, I think, and I needed all the pages I could to really build up these women. It's funny that you mention this, because some of my pre-readers have talked about how much they love Haynes, and they love who he is and his level head and how he doesn't require much in life to be happy. And he's very level-headed and yet a cool guy.
I felt really sorry for the security guard at the
house. Oh, me too. Me too. You know where I got that? When we were young, my girlfriends and me inside the dorm at Alabama, we had a security guard just like that. He was teased unmercifully, and you know, we do things when we're young and dumb, and I can't tell you the things as an older woman I have looked back on and regretted and thought, I've got to make that right one day. So that's where that character came from, because oftentimes we can't do anything about it, but we still feel bad about things. So he came from real life experience, something that breaks my heart to this day.
When I first went to Oxford on a football Saturday, which was an accident, I was just going down to Roanoke to see Faulkner's home and just had forgotten that football existed.
Oh, my gosh.
We drove past the Grove and I went, this is not typical. There's the old saying that Ole Miss says that we may not win the game, but we'll never lose a party. Is it different from Tuscaloosa and how things are over at Alabama, how they do?
I think Tuscaloosa learned from the Grove, and they picked up some of their fun party habits. Because now when you go to the Tuscaloosa Quad, as we call it, it looks much more like the Grove than it did when I was in school. But there's just not anything like the Grove. That is the party. You know, football is royalty in the South. And when they party in the Grove, they make sure that anybody that comes knows that. And it is the most fun. They spend a ton of money on parties. They invite all their friends. Their tents in the same places week after week. And people who party in the Grove look forward to it all year long. I mean, it is the place to be in Mississippi, the Grove, on a Saturday in the fall.
And watching those poor Greek pledges and members have to wear cocktail dresses and blazers and ties in 95-degree weather the end of August is just crazy.
But they love it. They want to do it. You know, they're excited about it. And one of my favorite things is when I've been there is to see the girls, and they look so cute and they're all dressed up and they've got their high heels in their two fingers on their right hand and their flip-flops on by the end of the evening, you know, because they always store flip-flops in their purse. And I love that, that they come equipped knowing that they're going to want to change their feet out of those heels. But they all wear them. It's dress-up time on Saturday morning.
I'm sure you have a lot of events scheduled for Over the South. This is going to be a topic that hits with a lot of people, and a lot of people are going to be interested. What all are you doing to promote the book this fall?
This time, I decided to do it a little differently. I hired an independent tour person, and she's just wonderful. And she has planned me the biggest tour I've ever done. I did book my own bookstore dates, and I'm going back to my traditional bookstores. Like, I'm going to Oxford the Friday of a football game, and I'm actually going to be there the day before bid day at Square Books. And, of course, I'm going to Turn Row in Greenwood, Pass Books in Pass Christian, Mississippi, and in Jackson, Lemuria. But other than that, my normal stores in Tennessee, which novel, I have to say, give my shout out to Novel because they're the greatest bookstore I know. They're so supportive of me, and everybody who works there is so kind and sweet and supportive. And I love that bookstore, so I'm launching it there, and I can't wait. But I'll also be in Nashville at Parnassus and Knoxville at Union Avenue. And I'm trying to go to cities where there's big fraternity and sorority presence. But I'm also speaking to women's groups and luncheons this time and doing things that are a little different where I have know that I'll have a bigger audience.
So what's the date and time for your appearance at Novel here in Memphis?
It is Tuesday, August 21st at 6 o'clock. And I cannot wait to come. Memphis is the most supportive of my work of anywhere. And I think that's probably because I'm from here. And I'm so grateful to everybody who has supported me over the years. And I have to say, I'm really proud of this book because I took time off to get better at my craft. I read a book called The Anatomy of Story by John Truby, and I spent 70 pages outlining. He really takes you through storytelling. And I tried really hard to learn more and to be able to deliver the best product I could.
Well, Lisa, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and sharing Rush with us. It's really been a pleasure.
Stephen, it is my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for letting me come on today. I love seeing you every time I'm here.
Lisa Patton is the author of Rush, which is published by St. Martin's Press. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.